Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. There's breaking news this morning that the federal government is recommending a pause in giving the Johnson & Johnson COVID vaccine because six women who received the shot developed rare and serious blood clots within around 2 weeks of their vaccinations. One of the women died. The New York Times reports another is in critical condition in Nebraska. The pause recommendation comes from both the Centers for Disease Control and the Food and Drug Administration. They have not concluded that the Johnson & Johnson vaccine caused the blood clots, but they want to look more closely at these six cases. About 7 million people in the U.S. have received the J&J shot, according to CDC data cited by the New York Times. All six of these reported cases occurred in women between the ages of 18 and 48, they say. The condition is known as cerebral venous sinus thrombosis, or CVST, and it's the same rare blood clot that's being examined as possibly being caused in a different small number of cases in Europe in people who got the AstraZeneca vaccine. In those cases, too, it was in people under 50. So what will this do to the overall vaccine effort in the United States and the current wave of the pandemic? What's the right risk-benefit analysis in deciding whether to keep using the J&J shot when so many people will get seriously ill and die from COVID, so many more, even if the vaccine turns out to be the cause of the blood clots in these six people out of the 7 million? In any case, the pause in the question suggests a challenge to the advice or maybe a reinforcement of the advice. We hear frequently from Dr. Fauci on what vaccine to pick.
I would pick the one that was the most readily available to me. All three of them are highly efficacious.
Fauci on CBS last month. The government is taking the steps right now to see that the Johnson & Johnson vaccine is not available to people for a while. So now we continue our series aimed at increasing vaccine access for the harder to schedule and harder to reach, and engaging with vaccine hesitancy or distrust. Back with us is S. Mitra Kalita, co-founder and publisher of Epicenter NYC, a newsletter to help New Yorkers get through the pandemic. Epicenter has helped more than 5,000 people navigate vaccine registration. She's also co-founder of URL Media, a network of black and brown-oriented news sites, and she was previously vice president at CNN Digital before launching her current news organizations. And also with us for this edition is Dr. Mark Horowitz, an independent family doctor in private practice in Lower Manhattan. He's affiliated with Mount Sinai. He's reserving 10% of the supply of vaccine he receives for the harder-to-reach people that Epicenter is trying to help out. And just last week, as it happens, he received 100 J&J doses to administer. And we have New York City Council Health Committee Chair Mark Levine, who has been tweeting this morning in response to the Johnson & Johnson news. So hi, Mitra and Councilman Levine, welcome back. And Dr. Horowitz, welcome to WNYC.
Thank you, Brian.
Thank you, Brian.
And I will just be candid here and tell our listeners that Mitra and Dr. Horowitz were booked for this time anyway, but the conversation we will have is, of course, changed by this breaking news, and we've added Councilmember Levine. So, Dr. Horowitz, first question to you. Will you take this federal recommendation and pause in your own administration of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine?
Absolutely.
And can you explain this rare blood clot called cerebral venous sinus thrombosis?
Yes. Unlike more common types of blood type clots, such as deep venous thrombosis of the legs or pulmonary embolus, which is a blood clot in the lungs, this is a very, very unusual type of blood clot that occurs in one of the principal blood vessels in the brain. So it's a catastrophic type of blood clot, but it's extraordinarily rare.
And Councilmember Levine, as City Council Health Committee Chair, what's your reaction and how will it affect city policy?
It's a serious blow, Brian, to our vaccine efforts. But I want to point out that so far there's been 240,000 doses of J&J given in New York City. Actually, I was one on Friday. And we don't know of any cases of this occurring. Doesn't mean it hasn't occurred, but there are no reported cases from patients who've had J&J so far in the city. I'm sure we'll talk about what this means practically, but this really has been a critical tool for us to reach populations that aren't well served by the other vaccines, homebound seniors, people experiencing homelessness. This is going to be the vaccine used on the new mobile vaccine clinics. And so this really, I think, is also a blow for equity. And I don't know how easily it's going to be to substitute the other vaccines for some of this more mobile work.
Mitra, would you pick up on that? Because I know so much of your work is also focused on access and equity.
Sure, Brian. It's been quite a morning. I would, you know, the volunteers who've been booking folks are just, they're so emotionally invested in exactly the group that Councilman Levine is talking about. And we, in some ways, have been pushing for the J&J vaccine to be more accessible and really decentralized, right? If you think about the nature of vaccine distribution, they've been at mega sites like the Javits Center and Citi Field. And we were just getting to a place where it felt like the vaccine was coming into the neighborhoods where people live and work. What we saw this morning, just to kind of give you an immediate on-the-ground reaction, dozens of folks who we've scheduled have already reached out by phone or email or calling the volunteers who they were in touch with, saying they heard the news, what should they do? So we've been trying to essentially be the conduit between, you know, the governor on Twitter who said, if you have an appointment today at a state-run site for J&J, you will be offered Pfizer. And so just getting out basic information feels like the first step. We always tell people we are not doctors, but one of my first messages this morning was to Dr. Horowitz himself to say, Dr. Horowitz, what should we do? And he suggested pausing. And so we've taken that guidance and said, look, we talked to a doctor and this is what he suggests. And the last thing I'll mention is that in some of these decentralized sites, pharmacies among them, there's still confusion as to whether they should follow the federal guidance. The state is saying they're switching to Pfizer and your appointment won't be canceled. We've seen a mixed reaction. Some sites are canceling the appointments outright and saying we'll get back in touch with you as soon as we know what's safe to give. Others are saying we're waiting for guidance from the supplier themselves as to whether we should keep going or not. And that's contributing a little bit to the confusion. My hope is that federal and state authorities make it much clearer what some of these local sites should be doing.
So City Council Member Levine, is that something that the city could contribute to? Again, for people just joining us, you're the chair of the health committee. It sounds like from Mitra, what Mitra was just saying, if I understood her correctly, that some pharmacies that have Pfizer doses available to give in addition to the Johnson & Johnson doses are not giving the Pfizer doses to their scheduled appointments today. They're just canceling them because they're just waiting to see, period, now. I'm not sure that's the right thing to do.
Yes, I flagged that for the health department, and they're working on that right now. It's such a decentralized system in the pharmacies. And you're right to point out that the CDC offered guidance, but that it's up to individual providers to make those decisions. And I also want to clarify a really important point that Mitra made. The city has sent out cancellations for appointments today for Johnson & Johnson, offering the opportunity to reschedule with one of the other vaccines. The state, for today at least, it may not extend beyond today, but at least for today, the state is honoring J&J appointments and using Pfizer. I presume that will be dependent on supply, and so I don't know if they've committed to that long term, but if anyone is out there, as Mitra said, has got an appointment at Javits or Aqueduct today. But I think we're going to have to do very strong messaging on the continued effectiveness and safety of the mRNA vaccines.
Meaning the Pfizer and the Moderna.
Yes, that's right. And my fear is that people's skepticism will extend to those other vaccines, which have been proven now hundreds of millions of doses delivered worldwide to be remarkably safe and effective. And even in the case of the Johnson & Johnson, it is the job of regulators to keep us safe And it's the job of scientists to continually evaluate the impact. And like with any medical intervention, sometimes it's safer with some groups than others. And preliminary information is, it seems this is a problem for of women, I guess, between the ages of 18 and 50. Dr. Horowitz, correct me on that. So it's possible that older adults may begin using Johnson & Johnson again. Again, important communication here. We want people not to lose confidence in vaccination overall, and understand that this is regulators doing their job, ultimately trying to keep us safe.
Dr. Horowitz, could you expand on what Councilmember Levine just alluded to there, which is to say, do you have a theory, or do you know of one from researchers as to why this might occur in these very rare cases after the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, but not after the Pfizer or Moderna vaccine, which use a different mechanism known as mRNA?
That's an excellent question. And so, first of all, I would say we all need to take a deep breath in and let it out and let scientists do their research. We've had pauses before, and those pauses have been lifted. I share Councilman Levine's concern that this pause will further influence people's hesitancy on the vaccine. But like the AstraZeneca vaccine in Europe, the Johnson & Johnson vaccine is an adenovirus vector vaccine, meaning it uses an inactivated virus that doesn't ordinarily infect humans to carry the DNA into our cells to produce the antibodies against the spike protein. So this situation is akin to what happened in Europe with the AstraZeneca vaccine, and both vaccines share the same mechanism of action. And in both cases, the disproportionate effect was on young women of childbearing age, and it was this very unusual form of blood clots in the brain, tragic but very unusual. And in both cases, we're talking about something that occurred in fewer than one out of a million doses. So I suspect with time the mechanism will be elucidated. I don't think it has yet. There's been speculation. I also suspect with time there may be some guidelines for using it in only certain populations, but I suspect that the pause will be lifted eventually. But unfortunately, what this does is further feeds the fire of vaccine hesitancy among a select group of citizens who may not get their information from reputable sources. And in practice here on the ground every day, I deal with patients who come in with information that may be flawed. And in some cases, I'm able to counsel them and show them the correct data and get them to take the vaccine. In other cases, people are pretty firm in their distrust of the vaccine. There may be cultural factors involved. There may be personal factors involved. But this is a continued challenge, and this challenge will only be intensified by this pause.
And listeners, if you're just joining us, let me just invite listeners and give out the phone number, because we can take phone calls. As we discuss the breaking news this morning that the federal government is recommending a pause in giving the Johnson & Johnson COVID vaccine because six women who received the shot developed rare and serious blood clots within around 2 weeks of their shot. One of the women died. The New York Times reports another is in critical condition in Nebraska. However, we should say that this is six reported cases that have not conclusively been linked to the vaccine out of 7 million doses of J&J that have been given in this country. But listeners, if you have a question, our phone number is 646-435-7280, 646-435-7280. For Dr. Mark Horowitz, who was just speaking, a family doctor in private practice in Lower Manhattan, affiliated with Mount Sinai, S. Mitra Kalita, co-founder and publisher of Epicenter NYC, a newsletter to help New Yorkers get through the pandemic. She's been helping thousands of people navigate vaccine registration. And New York City Council Health Committee Chair Mark Levine. Our lines are already full, as you're all not surprised to hear that, but it's 646-435-7280, or you can tweet a question at Brian Lehrer. Dr. Horowitz, I want to follow up on one thing right away. For people listening who have gotten the Johnson & Johnson vaccine already, although this is extremely rare. Are there early warning signs of this that people can look out for and get in touch with a doctor immediately if they start to feel something in particular?
Actually not. This is a fairly acute and catastrophic event. So it would be imprudent of me to say, well, if someone who got the Johnson & Johnson vaccine develops symptom A or symptom B, they should call their doctor, because there is some overlap between the natural side effects that we counsel patients they're going to get following this vaccine and some of the symptoms of cerebral sinus venous thrombosis. So it's really difficult to answer that question without giving some people some fear that the normal side effects of the vaccine might be an indication of this more catastrophic condition.
Let me take a call from Jack in Elmhurst, who says he's a doctor also and had the Johnson & Johnson vaccine himself. So let's see what Jack in Elmhurst, Queens has to say. Hi, Jack. You're on WNYC.
Oh, hi. Thank you for taking the call. So, yes, I've had the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. I'm fine. I actually think it's a better vaccine because its efficacy against the South African variety has actually been proven. I, of course, agree with Dr. Horwitz that we should follow FDA guidelines, but I think that the guidelines really should be modified, because 80% of the deaths are from COVID are for males, and there's been no deaths that I know of from the vaccine. And so they really should continue to get the vaccine, and that women who do have some deaths from Johnson on the side of caution could just recommend that they not get it and should be their decision. So that would seem to the rational and reasonable, flexible approach that Americans usually take instead of these blanket rules.
Dr. Horwitz, how much do you agree with that?
Well, I agree with my colleague. I do think that we need to take some time and let this be evaluated. The greatest minds in science are probably working on this right now. I agree that because of the disproportionate effect on women, that may be the first recommendation, is that women of a certain age choose one of the other vaccines. But I'd be speaking out of place if I speculated any further.
Mitra, do you want to say anything
about
that?
Yeah, I was just about to say, I do think that the vaccine hesitancy that we've been speaking of for two populations in particular who have historically been neglected in medicine and research, women and people of color, this is a chilling finding. And so I take the doctor's point entirely. And for many restaurant workers who are male, and if this is proven to be safe for men, the idea of being one and done with their J&J shot is still a really great thing in coming weeks to get us out of this. But for women in particular, you know, this is the second issue that has been raised with vaccines. The first was the lack of their testing on pregnant women. So that was a big question. The second is this one that's coming up. And just another that I'll mention that's come up just on some of our folks who we've been helping, as well as in some chat boards that I'm on, is around, you know, women getting their mammograms after the vaccine. They've been told not to do these. And these tend to be pretty sidebar issues in terms of coverage of the vaccine. And what I feel like the last few hours have shown us is we really need to front load 50% of the population and how this is affecting them as a core part of our messaging around this. And so, yeah, I'll just share a personal anecdote. Like, my family, most of us got the Moderna vaccine. I have a brother who's an engineer, another brother who's a mathematician. They went in and looked at the trials and said, did they test this on Asian communities? They sent me an article from the LA Times. They said, Mitra, we're good to go, right? This is fine for our parents. This is fine for us. You know, my 16-year-old got the Pfizer vaccine. I said to them, could you do this? Now, I didn't do all that because I'm the journalist, Brian. They're the kind of STEM-oriented members of our family. Mm-hmm. But we have to feel like people are looking out for us in that same way. And I hope that in the messaging of this, there's some way we can not introduce chaos, say this is a part of the research and remain calm, but also treat everyone as we would treat our own family and loved ones in this process.
Onika in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Onika.
Hi. I recently just got the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, and I went to one of the pop-up sites located in a majority Black community. And my concern is the continuity of care. So if members of the community exhibit those symptoms, what guarantee is that they're going to get adequate medical care to treat the symptoms of the thrombosis, opposed to it being dismissed as racialized medical concerns?
I understand, and that's the root of so much distrust of the medical system in general. Mitra, I'm sure you get the question. If symptoms develop in Black and brown people, they're not confident to begin with that they're going to get the same treatment from these side effects as from anything else in the medical system based on history and even current experience.
So there is a reason that folks like Dr. Horowitz are now within our network, because we were just finding that as we were going down these efforts, that the questions started to become more special cases and folks in some cases who don't have a primary care doctor. So the ability to refer people who at this point trust us to doctors and medical professionals has actually been pretty invaluable. I think there are clinics like, you know, Somos runs some. Dr. Horowitz himself has said he's wanted to reserve some of his vaccines, and I know his practice is very diverse. And that's kind of what we've been doing, is by word of mouth. I don't think that's a sustainable solution at all. I mean, it's not just the vaccine, but the entire past year has shown, at least here in the epicenter in Jackson Heights, Corona, and Elmhurst, there was a St. John's study done saying 42% of Latinos here don't have a primary care physician. I mean, that is unconscionable in a year that we've had a pandemic. So my hope, and maybe Councilman Levine wants to jump in here, but these require government solutions. I mean, I, as a volunteer, can only connect you so far. There is clearly much greater systemic problems.
We're going to take a break and continue. We have a clip that just came in from the FDA of somebody stating, in fact, some symptoms to watch out for that might be early warning signs of this. So we'll play that as soon as we continue and continue with our three guests and more of your calls. Stay with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, as we are talking about the breaking news this morning that the federal government is recommending a pause in giving the Johnson & Johnson COVID vaccine because six women ages 18 to 48 who received the shot developed rare and serious blood clots within around 2 weeks of their shots. One of the women has died. We have three guests, Dr. Mark Horowitz, a physician in private practice in Lower Manhattan, S. Mitra Kalita, co-founder and publisher of Epicenter NYC, a newsletter to help New Yorkers get through the pandemic. She's also been helping people navigate vaccine registration, and Mark Levine, the New York City Council Health Committee chair. And I want to play a clip of something that somebody from the FDA just said a short time ago. Let's see, this is Janet Woodcock, and she's talking about things to watch for in your own body in terms of symptoms in the first few weeks after you get the Johnson & Johnson vaccine.
For people who recently got the vaccine within the last couple weeks, they should be aware to look for any symptoms. If you've received the vaccine and developed severe headache, abdominal pain, leg pain, or shortness of breath, you should contact your healthcare provider and seek medical treatment.
Mark Levine, I know you were trying to get in before. Do you want to react to that or say anything you want?
Absolutely. I was reacting to some of the reports I was seeing from this simultaneous press conference. A clarification on the age range of women who have been impacted so far. It's 18 to 38. And I'm not sure if that was covered in the clip, but they said that if you've had your dose of Johnson & Johnson a month ago or prior to that, that you're at very low risk. But I want to echo a broader point that Mitra's making, which is that this news is coming at a really unfortunate moment for the city, as we're about to transition to a whole new stage of vaccination. We've made so much progress. We're at 42% of adults vaccinated overall, but there's still enormous inequity. Only about a quarter of African-American and Latino New Yorkers have had at least one shot. And the next phase is going to be much more about building trust in the vaccine, about taking the vaccine to people where they are. And the loss of Johnson & Johnson as a tool for that, because it's so much easier to be mobile, because it only requires a single dose, so easier to work with transient populations. But also the blow to confidence in the program overall at the moment where really our number one challenge is no longer going to be how can motivated people navigate through a complicated website system. It's going to be how can we as a city build trust in this vaccine and get it to people. So the timing of this is really unfortunate. And I think we're going to have the most intense messaging we've had so far in the vaccination process
to communicate, you know, To reinforce that point, and Council Member, I'll give you an opportunity to follow up on this. We can take this pause that they're now recommending in administering the Johnson & Johnson vaccine as a reason for confidence in the other vaccines, it seems to me, because the government is stepping in to recommend this pause based on, you know, a little bit of evidence that there may be a problem in very rare cases with the J&J. It indicates that the government is not sidestepping this. The government is dealing with potential side effects from vaccines head on. And so that's a reason for trust rather than distrust, would you say?
This is absolutely right. This is how scientific oversight is supposed to work. And this should give people confidence that we're taking it seriously. But boy, I've seen a lot of bad takes already on social media this morning. And, I'm very worried that, there'll be spillover effect into confidence in the mRNA vaccine. So let's ramp up our communication. These vaccines are safe and effective. And Brian, we have to mention that any evaluation on a vaccine has to be weighed against the risk of getting COVID-19. And that risk remains all too real in New York City. We're still seeing 3,000 cases or more a day and close to 200 people being hospitalized a day. So we do want to remind people that the pandemic's not over, and any evaluation you make has to be weighed against the risk of doing nothing, which is real.
Maggie in Park Slope, you're on WNYC. Hi, Maggie.
Hey. I was just kind of intrigued to know how your guests would compare this risk with the Johnson & Johnson vaccine to the risk that I, and I think many, many, many other women have faced for years and years and years about oral contraceptives, which had a risk of blood clots, as I recall. And I, with the help of my doctor, weighed that risk and was quite happy to accept it.
Maggie, thank you. And I think we might have somebody calling on another line who's very well positioned to answer that question. And it is Ron in Boston, who is a neurosurgeon, so presumably he knows brain blood clots. And I'll say by way of full disclosure, he's somebody I know who happens to be a personal friend, and I know he's a prominent neurosurgeon in Boston. So, hi, Ron, you're on WNYC.
Oh, hi, Brian, how you doing?
Okay.
Anyway,
what can you say to that last caller, first of all? Did you hear her?
Yes, there that correlation between oral contraceptive use and increased thrombotic complications is well known, and it is interesting that the women who have suffered this rare but serious blood clot are of childbearing age. And so it'll be interesting to see if that turns out to be the relationship, that somehow there's a reaction between the vaccine, the J&J vaccine, and oral contraceptive use that led to this, in which case it would be a very restricted population that couldn't receive the vaccine. So I just wanted to
That's very interesting. Yeah, because they all do seem to be occurring in women of childbearing age, more or less. Based on that, Ron, is there any mechanism that looks apparent to you as a neurosurgeon, as a brain specialist, anything from this particular vaccine that jumps out at you as might be causing this?
No, nothing obvious, but that correlation is, you know, very interesting, at least in terms of looking at who are the people that have suffered this complication. It is something that occurs more in women than men in general. And the fact that it's occurring in women of childbearing age who might happen to also be on oral contraceptives, it could be that this is not a broad problem with the vaccine, mm-hmm. but just this particular population should not take it, perhaps.
Ron,
we'll
thank
have to
you
see
so
how,
much for,
how it plays out.
So much for calling in.
Brian, could I just add one thing?
Council Member Levine, and then I want to go to Dr. Horowitz to get a second medical opinion, but go ahead, Council Member.
Very quick, only because I'm seeing updates coming out of the CDC press conference, and they've just clarified something on this point, which is that this pause is a recommendation, not a mandate. I'm reading here that if an individual provider talks with their patient, they could determine that the Johnson & Johnson vaccine is their best option and still administer it.
But nothing since you're monitoring the simultaneous FDA news conference, they haven't mentioned birth control pills in particular, or if the women who suffered these blood clots were taking birth control pills?
No, they've only specified it was women between the ages of 18 and 38, 6 to 10 days after getting the vaccine.
And I know you're hearing it as 18 to 38. I heard it elsewhere as they reaffirmed 18 to 48, but something in that range. Dr. Horowitz, what do you think about our neurosurgeon caller's theory from Boston?
Well, that's quite possible. I don't recall seeing any association between oral contraceptive use and cerebral venous thrombosis in the European populations affected by the AstraZeneca vaccine. I think there they invoked some sort of immune mechanism for this. I think, again, we need to take a deep breath and let the scientists do their work. The original subject of this panel was to be vaccine choice, and I want to emphasize there still is a great deal of choice. The Johnson & Johnson vaccine represents a very small proportion of vaccines being shipped to the population of the United States right now. And in fact, we were about to enter a week-long period of drought for the J&J vaccine owing to the situation with the factory in Baltimore that had a quality control issue. So there's still plenty of vaccine out there of the Moderna and Pfizer variety. And this should not by any means prevent people from seeking a place to be vaccinated now that the eligibility for vaccination is everybody age 16 years of age and older. We are, as Councilman Levine pointed out, and as we know all too well, we're in a race against time with these variants, and these vaccines are extremely effective against those variants. The majority of the infections that we're seeing in New York City right now are either the unique New York variant or the UK variant. We fortunately haven't been affected by either the Brazilian or the South African variant to any significant degree yet, but we've got to get a significant number of people in the population vaccinated to win the race against these variants. These variants are highly transmissible. In my own practice, I'm seeing several new cases a week, predominantly young people, and predominantly young people who are not vaccinated in their virus. People, when I ask them, how do you think you came in contact with this? Their answer is, I'm following all the rules. I don't know. So clearly these variants are highly mm-hmm. transmissible, and we're in a race against time to defeat them. So people have to continue to be vaccinated. Let's put the issue of the Johnson & Johnson aside for a couple of days until we get some answers from the scientific community. But in the meantime, there seems to be an adequate supply of the Pfizer and the Moderna vaccine to meet demand. And we've got to get people vaccinated to defeat these variants.
It's such an important point that I'll repeat it, that the overall risk to the population from the faster spread of the virus than from the side effects of the vaccines might make it a risk-benefit analysis that argues to continue the use of this vaccine, even with the risk after this this pause. That's such a difficult public health decision, though. Dr. Horowitz, give us one more deeper take into this. If you know, in other kinds of vaccines or medications, what's generally considered an acceptable side effects rate to allow something to remain in use because the benefits still far outweigh the risks? In this case, it seems to be something like a ratio of 6 serious side effects to 7 million doses.
Sure. And in my career in medicine, there have been similar issues with new drugs that are introduced or existing drugs that have turned out to have unrecognized side effects during their introduction. And we've made decisions to use them because the disease they treat is far more serious than the complication. And again, 6 out of 7 million seems just like such a, I mean, it's tragic for the individuals involved, but the alternative of a large number of people getting COVID and the complications thereof just seems unacceptable. So I share your perspective on the risk-benefit analysis, but at least in the short term, we're in a time now when the Johnson & Johnson vaccine was going to have a dip in supply because of the factory issues, and there seems to be plenty of Pfizer and Moderna vaccine out there. I have a close relationship with the pharmacists in my community here, and many of them have more than enough vaccine to provide patients who make appointments. Some of them call me near the end of the day and ask me if I have any patients who would be willing to take their leftover vaccine. So we're not in a drought situation. We're just in a drought situation with respect to one of the choices. I think that there seems to be adequate supply of the other two choices, and people should continue to be vaccinated if they're eligible to get vaccinated.
Mitra, you want to give us a closing 30-second thought and maybe even referring to, as Dr. Horowitz said, what was going to be the topic of this conversation today, which is vaccine choice. And if people could be shopping and say, oh, I prefer the Pfizer or I prefer the Moderna, something like that.
I think it's a really good point. So Pfizer and Moderna, and also that Epicenter is still here to help New Yorkers get their vaccine. So hello at epicenter-nyc.com. I do think, Brian, sometimes you ask me if I were running things, what would I do? Which we can only dream. But the elderly homebound women, if they are okay with the J&J vaccine, the number of women we have over the age of 100 in New York City who are waiting for a vaccine is quite long. And so the sooner we can get them that. And then on this note about scheduling has been a big reason why J&J was so appealing to large segments of our population. I think if the city could continue to operate its decentralized, mobile vans in your community, the pharmacies, the churches, the mosques, and let's keep them there for a few days and say your first dose and your second dose will be 21 days or 28 days apart, and these will be here for a week at a time, but just start to get this in the consciousness of folks to make it easy for them. And the last thing I'll say on just vaccine kind of shopping, if you will, we need to get the message out that the side effects vary by individual. We get phone calls every day and emails saying, I don't want this vaccine because my brother was laid up for 2 days. This other vaccine, we just don't know how your body will respond, and that's a very individual thing.
Mitra Kalita, Dr. Mark Horowitz, City Council Health Committee Chair Mark Levine, thank you all for joining us.
Thank you, Brian.
Thank you, Brian.
Thank you.